From the KTOO newsroom in Juneau, I'm Yvonne Quimry. During most of May, red dresses and other red clothing hung from trees around Ward Lake near Ketchikan. They were symbols of missing and murdered Indigenous people from southern Southeast. But as KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, almost 50 of them have disappeared. Some have turned up, buried, or near pipes around the trail.
Dozens of red clothes, some trailing adult-sized gowns, some child-sized frilly frocks, swayed from trees all around Ward Lake in May. They're a tangible reminder of real lives lost, each one representing Indigenous people who were murdered or are still missing. But then, most of them disappeared before they were due to be taken down.
It's just disrespectful.
Michael Toole is the Victim Services Program Coordinator for the local tribe, Ketchikan Indian Community.
That's a terrible way to discount the reality of the lives of some of these people who are missing relatives who haven't received justice.
Toole says he checked on the dresses in mid-May. The tribe held a permit to hang the dresses through the end of the month. That's according to a U.S. Forest Service spokesperson.
And there had been some that were, weathered. I mean, the weather was off and on, mixed bag with rain and wind, and some were tattered, but certainly none that I recall being missing.
There were 60 garments hung as part of the installation. When staff went back to take them down late last month, most of them were gone. The tribe checked in with Alaska State Troopers and the Forest Service, but they didn't know what had happened to the dresses. There was outcry on social media. The tribe's council issued a statement condemning what they called, quote, a hurtful and disrespectful act that undermines the efforts to bring understanding and raise awareness about the MMIP epidemic. They asked anyone with information to contact local law enforcement, but also to contact the tribe and learn more about the epidemic. Some of the dresses have started to turn up in the past few days. Pictures of wet, crumpled dresses appeared on social media.
A number of these dresses had been collected and discarded off the trail and covered up next to a culvert there.
Gloria Burns is Ketchikan Indian Community's vice president and the chair of the Social Services Committee.
They've been found in the lake vicinity, just, you know, back, almost like they were stuffed into the drain pipe.
Burns says the act left her with a deep feeling of sorrow. She says it felt like a, quote, intentional, almost vicious attack. Burns says that the tribe staff hung the dresses with remembrance and intention, trying to make it what she called a safe space.
And so when you're going through that process of trying to create a safe space, and then it's intentionally made unsafe, it feels very much like a violation. And I think, you know, the hard part is that missing and murdered Indigenous people has been happening since colonization. We really don't talk about it. You know, we haven't really spoke those, you know, to the outside community.
The Tribal Council encourages all Ketchikan residents to reach out to Ketchikan Indian Community and learn more about the MMIP crisis. Burns also hopes that whoever removed the clothing talks to someone and tries to understand why they did it. In Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Aquaculture, or mariculture, is a fledgling industry in Alaska with big potential. The federal government announced Thursday that it plans to help identify areas of Alaska state waters best suited for shellfish and marine plant farms. KSTK's Sage Smiley reports.
Alaska has so much coastline, it's just a few thousand miles shy of being able to wrap around the Earth twice. And the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, wants to help the state of Alaska identify areas along its coast best suited for growing marine plants and shellfish. Danielle Blacklock is the director of NOAA Fisheries Office of Aquaculture.
As a complement to wild-harvested seafood, aquaculture, or mariculture, is vital for supporting our nation's coastal communities and feeding our growing population. In a changing climate, we must look to the ocean for sustainable food, as foods from the sea are good for people, good for the planet, and good for the economy.
It's a somewhat new endeavor for NOAA. They're already working to identify what they call aquaculture opportunity areas, or AOAs, in Southern California and the Gulf of Mexico, but those are in federal waters.
Alaska presents a really exciting opportunity to show how dynamic this planning process can be.
During a press call June 1st, BlackRock said this will be the first partnership focusing on state waters, within 3 miles of Alaska's coastline specifically. It'll require collaboration between state and federal agencies.
So that means a true partnership with the state.
BlackRock says Alaska's plan will focus solely on marine invertebrates and macroalgae, since farming finfish in state waters is illegal. She explained NOAA will use environmental, economic, and cultural data to determine the size and location for potential aquaculture development zones.
They will produce a peer-reviewed aquaculture opportunity atlas that shares this data and the resulting maps with the public.
BlackRock says the decision to look into aquaculture opportunities in Alaska comes after public support from Alaska Native organizations, multiple arms of the Alaska state government, and fisheries stakeholders during public comment in 2020. State officials are publicly welcoming the collaboration. They say the rapid increase in aquaculture projects in Alaska necessitates collaboration and new innovative solutions. Sam Raybung is the head of commercial fisheries for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, which oversees operational permits for aquatic farms in Alaska. The state's ambitious goal envisions a $100 million mariculture industry in Alaska by 2040.
The collaborative effort necessary to establish aquaculture opportunity areas will provide an opportunity for agencies and stakeholders to ensure important current uses and activities are identified and considered in advance.
Raybung says a large part of evaluating permit applications is evaluating their proposed locations. Although no areas are off limits, having predetermined opportunity areas will help streamline the process, which involves an aquatic land lease from the State Department of Natural Resources and an operational permit from ADF&G.
We're not interested in leasing or permitting an area that's going to create a conflict. And to me, that's the biggest value of this exercise, is we're going to identify areas of potential conflict in advance so people don't play wrong guess when they are applying for farm sites.
The announcement comes as Alaska is moving to bolster its mariculture industry from within. A bill signed into law by Governor Mike Dunleavy last July expands permitting for farming shellfish like crab, razor clams, or abalone. There's also interest in the environmental benefits of aquatic plants as a way to fight climate change. NOAA plans to finance the science and public outreach through funding already appropriated specifically for use in aquaculture. State agencies will operate within their existing budgets. Plus, there is funding headed for Alaska mariculture, a $49 million grant cluster from the federal government, more than $25 million for mariculture research from the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council, and a $5 million mariculture matching grant from the state legislature. Next is outreach within Alaska communities and organizations. This planning process may take upwards of 3 years, but BlackRock says it's all to feed the growth of a productive and sustainable mariculture industry in Alaska. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
And two people remain missing after a charter vessel capsized near Sitka over Memorial Day weekend. The 30-foot aluminum boat was returned to Sitka by a salvage crew yesterday. The search began on the evening of May 28th after Kingfisher Charters notified the Coast Guard that one of their boats was overdue. The body of 57-year-old Mari Akawili was recovered from the scene on May 28th near the vessel that was partially capsized offshore of Low Island. His wife, 53-year-old Danielle Akawili, and her sister, 56-year-old Brandy Chow, were recovered from the boat on May 31st. The fourth passenger, 61-year-old Robert Soulis, and the boat's captain, 32-year-old Morgan Rabideau, still haven't been found. Conditions on the water made accessing and recovering the partially submerged boat challenging. Salvage crews refloated and returned the vessel back to Sitka yesterday. A press release from the Alaska State Troopers says search efforts moving forward will only occur if new clues or information are reported to law enforcement. Renewed search efforts would be evaluated at that time. The Coast Guard continues to investigate the circumstances surrounding the incident. And a plan to map the seafloor of the entire planet will see researchers operating out of Nome this summer and fall. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has contracted with a multinational engineering firm to scan the seabed, looking for both water depth and topographical details. Two research vessels, the RV Thunder and the RV Norseman II, will collect data 24 hours a day, 7 days a week through September. Also, a pair of unmanned automated research vessels will skim the surface to conduct research.
It can do about 10 days, has about a 10-day endurance, so can be out there for 10 consecutive days, running 24-hour operations, and it sleeps about 10 people on it.
Dave Neff is a hydrographer with Wilpert, the company contracted to complete the research. He says the mariners and scientific crew aboard the two ships will make regular calls on the port of Nome. He said hydrographic data was most recently collected in the 1930s. Ocean floor mapping dates to 1807 when President Thomas Jefferson created the U.S. Coast Survey Office. It's about 50 degrees. You're listening to KTOL.